Okay, so I will tell you about work that we did with Miguel Casalila and Andrew Ho, respectively from Donostia Center in Spain, and Andrew is now in Imperial College, on 1D physics and quasi-1D physics in cold atoms. And I will try to explain you why it's interesting to do this type of things with cold atoms, and why it's interesting to do these things at all. And the organizers asked me to do it a black ball talk, and also that it doesn't last more than 5 hours, so we'll try to compromise. After the title, I will go back to the blackboard for a while and then show you essentially experimental data. Again, chalk. Okay, so if I want to try to explain what is interesting, yeah, thank you. What is interesting in looking at quasi one-dimensional physics, the idea is very simple, that if you are in low dimension, then interactions are important, are special, let's say, or important. And if you are in high dimension, then interactions are not so important. And examples of that, for example, for fermions, you all know, if you're in high dimension, the thing that describes a fermionic system is something called a Fermi liquid, where essentially the fermions behave, quote, as free fermions. The interactions are not that drastic. If you go, so if I want to take fermions, for example, high dimension, you would get a Fermi liquid, which we understand quite decently now. And then in low dimension, you get another state of matter, which is called Luttinger liquid, with completely different type of excitations, completely different correlation functions. And this is something which is really driven by the interaction. Here you can, in first approximation, forget the interaction. So it's not to say that, of course, in high dimension you cannot get strong interaction effects, but you have to make the interaction strong, and you have to do something nasty to the system. The point is to say here, you get something which in low dimension is one type of physics, in high dimension you get another type of physics. So what happens if now you take chains, which are one-dimensional physics, you allow the quantum particle to hop from one chain to the other via some kinetic energy, and essentially you want the characteristic energy for this transverse hopping to be much smaller than the longitudinal characteristic energy. And so what happens when you change a control parameter in the system, namely temperature or frequency or some energy, then what you can expect is the following. You can expect that, let me put temperature here as a control parameter. When you are in high temperature, larger than, let's say, this characteristic energy, no coherent motion can take place between the chains. So you will see the 1D physics. So you can expect to essentially see 1D physics. And then at a certain temperature, or and again, this can be an energy, any other characteristic energy scale, then the coherent motion of the particle will take place along the chain, perpendicular to the chain, and then you will have to deal with a 2D or a 3D system. So you have something which is a dimensional crossover, that can be controlled by, again, a control parameter like the temperature, or alternatively you can keep the temperature fixed and vary the perpendicular hopping. But the main point is that you will go from, again, a 1D phase to a 3D phase, and of course the 3D phase will remember somehow that it comes from a strongly correlated 1D system. And how this dimensional crossover takes place is something that is really poorly understood. You had a question, or I saw you wondering.
Like a
Okay, so let me say it that way. There are two ways. I can give you two arguments. One is to say again, if you want to see the fact that you get quantum coherence between the two chains, your electron need to go there and somehow, electron or bosons or whatever, need to go there and come back. And it doesn't need to lose anything in coherence between the time it has left the chain and the time it comes back. So if the temperature is high, it will lose its coherence by the time it comes back to the chain. Okay? So essentially, it doesn't matter if he has gone to explore another chain and come back, or if he has just propagated along the chain. Another way to see it for fermions is the following. Let me do the Fermi surface of an object like this. It will be an open Fermi surface like this, whose widths here, so this is K perp, sorry, this is K perp, this is K parallel, the widths here is T perp, and this would be the Fermi surface of a pure 1D system, which is two sheets, essentially, and the Fermi surface is slightly warped because of the perpendicular hopping. So this is taking an energy epsilon of K parallel K perp, which is minus T parallel cosine K parallel minus T perp cosine K perp. Okay? Now, you see that if the temperature is large, then thermal excitation will sort of blur this Fermi surface by width, which is of order T here. And now, if T is larger than T perp, how do you know you didn't start from a completely flat Fermi surface? You have no way of really knowing. So there is no way to distinguish this system with a warped Fermi surface from a system with a completely flat Fermi surface that would be blurred by the temperature in the same way. If, on the other hand, the blurring is much smaller than the width, then you're able to say that there is a warping of the Fermi surface. So you're again in 3D regime. Yeah.
I mean, you might get into these details later, but you need to really distinguish. I would think you need to really distinguish whether you're talking about temperature or zero temperature, finite temperature, whether that parameter matters qualitatively, whether that parameter is temperature or energy, let's say.
It depends for which quantity.
Well, you're coupling 2D XY models, let's say, versus, you know, 1D XY models, and the relevance of that hopping is very different.
Right? I will come to that, but you're right. But for most quantities, it doesn't matter whether it's temperature, for example, or frequency of a probe you use. Like if you do optical conductivity on this system, the frequency of the optical conductivity will act also to give you the dimensional crossover in the same way. But you're right. There are,
in some cases, you actually have a transition.
Not here. Here, for the case I described, you don't. But let me come in 5 minutes to a case where you will have a transition. Yeah.
But for now, you're talking about crossover.
For now, it's a crossover.
You said that how this crossover takes place is not understood. So at some level, it is understood. What are the questions?
Okay. So there are several questions that one could ask for these things. The thing I want to focus is when there is a transition. And I'll come to this in 1 second. But already for the crossover, the question you want to know is, A, what is this energy scale TC? And there are arguments starting from renormalization from the high temperature to try to give you this energy. But what is the most difficult question is, even if here you have, let's say, a simple phase like Fermi liquid, what are the characteristics of this Fermi liquid? So what is understood is globally the idea that you will go from, let's say, a Luttinger liquid or a 1D phase to a 3D phase. But if you want to know the characteristics of this 3D phase, this is a much more complicated issue. For example, if it's a Fermi liquid, how does the lifetime of the excitation varies along the Fermi surface? How the quasi-particle residue varies along the Fermi surface? You know, you could say it's not important, it's just a Fermi liquid, but of course, if you have a really short lifetime at some point of the Fermi surface, like this, for example, it will change completely the physical observable you will measure in an experiment. So this is exactly the type of things that one wants to understand. And it's very difficult because you have to go through this dimensional crossover. And the tools that are good to tackle the 1D phase, namely bosonization, are not good to tackle the 3D phase, and the tools which are good to tackle the 3D phase, namely diagrammatic expansion or whatever, are completely failing when you want to use, when you want to tackle the 1D phase. So it's extremely complicated to have something that covers both sides of the transition, of the crossover. Okay, to make things worse, or to make things more interesting, it's even more interesting when the low dimensional phase is gapped. And it's not a crazy situation. This is something.
Which gap?
I will give an example. So this is not a crazy situation because, as I said, the interactions are important in low dimension. So, for example, I will give two examples, but as an example, it's very easy to get a phase which is a Mott insulator. In low dimension, much more easy than it is in three dimensions. In one dimension for fermions, for example, as soon as you get repulsion, you will get a Mott insulator provided you're commensurate, provided you get one particle per site. If you're in 3D, you know that you need a finite strength of the order of the bandwidth for the interaction to give you a Mott insulator. So it's very easy to have something which is gapped in low dimension. And I'll give another and simpler example in 5 seconds. But now let me consider the following problem. You have the chains. You have this Mott insulator in the chains. And essentially, Mott insulator means that the kinetic energy is completely blocked. But now, when you put the perpendicular hopping, you're increasing the kinetic energy. So you're making the Mott insulator unstable. So this time, what you can expect, if I draw a phase diagram as a function of temperature and perpendicular hopping, is a real transition where you will go from a phase which is a 1D Mott insulator to a phase which will kill the Mott insulating phase, will keep the gap, will kill the gap, and give you a three-dimensional metal or something else. Metal, superfluid, whatever. Depends whether you have bosons, fermions, or something. And this is a real quantum phase transition. And this quantum phase transition is, you know, the crossover was poorly understood. This one is even more poorly understood, especially for fermions. I will try to tell you today about bosons, what one can do for this in terms of bosons. And you could say, okay, again, why do I care for a phase transition at t equals zero? But again, you probably heard in the talk by Subir, and if not, reading Subir's book, that the properties of this quantum phase transition extend, of course, at finite temperature. And so here you will get a Mott insulating phase. This scale is essentially the scale of the Mott gap. Okay? And when you will increase the perpendicular hopping, the Mott gap will go to zero. And at some point, something here will happen. And let me put a big question mark here, because people do not even know if there is one transition or two transitions. This is an open issue at the moment. Then here, if you're above this energy scale, you will see a critical regime, let's say a Luttinger liquid. And then if you go here, this is where you see the three-dimensional metal. But again, you have this dimensional crossover scale that I was mentioning. So here is the high dimensional. No, the transition, no. But the effects of the transition give you, so these lines are crossovers, if you prefer. I can write them as like this. But the fact that this transition is there will completely drive the finite temperature properties. Okay. Let me give you a simpler example, which I cannot resist giving, even if it's a little cheating. Okay, so this is the thing I will discuss today for the case of bosons. For fermions, it's much more complicated. And I hope that either Miguel, Casalila, or Andrew will tell you about it, because I won't have time unless you really want a five-hour seminar. But I won't have time today to tell you about it. But the case of bosons is a little bit simpler. And in addition, there are experiments with cold atoms that deal with bosons. So I want to tell you about it. But let me give you another example of, okay, it's a simple example of such. Okay, so this one is something which is called deconfinement transition, because you change at the same time the nature of the phase, which goes from gapped to ungapped, and essentially at the same time the dimensionality of the system. The system goes from a 1D system, essentially driven 1D system, to something which now becomes a 3D system. So it's like if the system was sort of exploding, if you want, from the 1D phase to the 2D phase. Let me take an example of spin systems, and take a system where I get, okay, let me take a system like this. So I get strong bonds here, forming dimers. And then I get weaker bonds here.
Is that a two-dimensional system?
3D. I cannot draw the bonds in the perpendicular direction. You can make it 2D. You will just change the nature of this phase here. And so one bond is, let's call it J perp here. And let's call this one J. Or rather, I should be consistent with my notations and call this J perp. So if J perp is 0, you know how to diagonalize this. You get two spins here. So you get four states, one singlet, and three triplets. That's very simple. So you get these three sides. And if you look at the energy, you get the singlet here, and you get the three triplets here. Now, if I put a small J perp, nothing will happen, because the state has a gap, and that's all. You get singlets, and then you get a bunch of decoupled singlets, so you get a zero-dimensional problem. So this is, instead of being a one-dimensional problem here, what I'm describing here is a zero-dimensional problem. But now, let me assume that I put a magnetic field on the system. So if I... Sorry?
If you put on J perp,
well, it will certainly change the dispersion relation for the triplet, but they are excited states. So the ground state is still consisting of putting all singlets on the bonds and leaving the system as it is. Okay? But now let me put the magnetic field and see what happens as a function of magnetic field. So if J perp is 0, the problem is very simple. One triplet stays there, one triplet goes up, one triplet goes down, and there will be a critical field here, at which point the energy of the lowest triplet becomes smaller than the singlet, and so everybody flops triplet. Okay? Now, I put my J perp. The thing it does, as you said, it gives some kinetic energy to the triplet, because now the triplet can hop from one bond to the other, which means that this level gets broadened. And you see what happens, instead of having one transition here, I get 2 points. One is HC1, the other is HC2, where here the lowest triplet in K-space will become smaller than the singlet, so some bonds will start transforming into triplet, and here I've made everybody into triplet. Okay, what is this problem? So this is a problem where essentially you will go from a zero-dimensional problem to something which becomes a 3D problem, because the kinetic energy which is provided by the J-perp, I can give you the ref where you can play with this. There are several papers that dealt with this, but let me give you. This one is FizRef B59-1398, and this was in 99. And essentially, you go to a system where the triplet will be able to hop from one side to the other. Now, what is this problem? Okay, let me say I keep only the two states here, and I decide that I replace these two states by the presence of a boson. So when I get the singlet, I get nobody. When I get the triplet, I get a boson. And what you get is a bunch of bosons jumping on a three-dimensional lattice. So what this problem will give you is a transition between a state which has zero magnetization when you get in the singlet, and then when you reach HC1, because you start injecting triplets, you start magnetizing your system up to the point where you saturate everybody. And this you can view as taking a 3D system of bosons and simply filling it. It's a Bose condensation. So I cannot resist showing here this example, because in a moment we will do condensed matter with Bose condensate. Here it's a way to do Bose condensate with condensed matter. And it's Bose condensation of the triplons. So this is BEC of triplons. And you can describe very well here this transition by simply using the things you know from BEC. So this is one case where we know how this deconfinement transition takes place and what are all its characteristics going from a 0D problem to a 3D problem. But this is one of the few cases where we know that. So let me, before I proceed, let me just show you one or two examples. If I can switch it on. Oh yeah, apparently something is happening. Let me just show you one or two examples where these questions have been important. And the other example that exists for this type of dimensional crossover and quantum phase transition are the organic conductors. So I just want to show you that. Okay, interesting interference pattern. So again, this is the kind of thing I want to study, and maybe while this thing is warming up, okay, no, it does.
Let's see. SZ is conserved in this problem.
SZ is conserved in this problem.
So that's why you...
Yeah. So here, the magnetic field acts as a chemical potential for the bosons, so it's really working the Bose-Einstein, the Bose condensation at a fixed chemical potential, not fixed number of particles. So this is a cute example. Okay, so just let me, this was a slide recalling what I was saying, just to show you that this is observed. Here are experiments which are done on a compound which is thallium copper chloride, and you clearly see, so this is essentially magnetic field and temperature. You clearly see that the Bose-Einstein transition, there are consequences of this Bose-Einstein transition on the magnetization. I don't want to enter into this detail, but so the fact that there is this Bose-Einstein condensation is seen. The phase, the dispersion relation for the triplet has been mapped out by neutrons by Christian Rueg and collaborators. And you can, sorry? This one? This is magnetic field versus temperature, and this is the location of the transition. Of the phase boundary. And in fact, you can, you know the exponent here because this is essentially dilute Bose gas. So you can predict what is the critical exponent here for this transition. And even the Goldstone mode for this object has been observed. So just to say that in that case, we know fairly well what is this deconfinement transition.
Your graph right there somehow,
this one? Somehow. This one? Yeah. No, this is the magnetization as a function of temperature.
Oh.
Not as a function of magnetic field. And one consequence that you have to work out, that we worked out in this paper that I mentioned with Alexei, for example, is that you get a very weird effect that the magnetization as a function of temperature is non-monotonous when the condensate starts. And this is observed. So you see the magnetization goes down with temperature, and then bing, it goes up again when it hits the TC. This is a little bit weird effect. I don't have any gut feeling for this, but this is what happens. Okay, let me go to the more close case of the chains, couple chains that I was mentioning. For example, yeah, sorry.
Sorry, General. Yeah. Before you move away from this, I just want to ask, is there an analog of this? Okay, so this is Bose condensation of HC1. There's no analog of HC2, right?
Yes, it's the same. Because essentially, if you go to HC2, nearly all sites are occupied by triplets, and you get a few sites which are singlet. So you can do the opposite. You can say now, essentially, each time I get a singlet, I get a boson. There is particle hole symmetry, if you want, for this problem. So the transition at HC1 and the transition at HC2 are essentially the same. Now, if you have really the system I mentioned, there is no complete particle hole symmetry because you get the higher states. But if you keep only the two lower states, the singlet and the lowest triplet, then this problem can be mapped directly onto a spin 1/2 chain, and then it's just fully polarized down and fully polarized up, quote, spin 1/2 chain. So this is the same transition here. And in fact, in many of the, so this is something that has completely exploded. Now there are several groups that are looking at this type of transitions, at this type of transition in various compounds. And very often it's more convenient for these people to work around HC2 rather than HC1. But okay. So are there other questions on this? I don't want to enter too much into the details for this one because it's not the focus of my talk, but now that's the interest of doing a blackboard talk, is that it's flexible. So if you have questions.
No, it's very
good. Okay. So essentially, just to show you, here are examples of compounds which are organic conductors, which goes under the name of Bechgaard salts, which are made of chains of molecules like this, which are widely separated in the crystal, so that it's much more easy for the electrons to move along the chains like this, rather than perpendicular to the chain. So to give you an order of magnitude of the energies, the Hopping integral here is essentially 3,000 Kelvin. The Hopping of electrons perpendicular is one order of magnitude less, 300 Kelvin. And then there is a third direction where it's 30 Kelvin. Okay, so these are exactly an example of these coupled one-dimensional chains. And because they are commensurate, they are Mott insulators if you don't do something about it. And you see, they have a quite complicated phase diagram that people still don't fully understand. Forget SP, it means spin pyrrole phase. This is an antiferromagnetic phase. This is a superconducting phase whose symmetry is totally unknown. People have no idea what is the symmetry. They fight between triplet and singlet. So it's not even like in the ITC where at least people know the symmetry. And this is a Mott insulating phase. No. I think people up to a couple of months ago would have put all their money on the triplet because there were experiments of HC2 which were in excess of the Pauli limit, so it would make it hard for being a singlet. But now there is an NMR experiment by the group of Stuart Brown in UCLA and Denis Jérôme in Orsay, which claim that they see the night shift changing when they go below TC, so it goes more for singlet. And I'm sure there will be blood on the wall in the next conference on organics to discuss in a civilized manner about this issue. But okay, so the symmetry is not known. You see, in ITC, to know the symmetry, people did in let's say, phase experiments, which are extremely difficult to do for the organics. So if one could do this experiment, probably it would help. To decide whether it's singlet or triplet? You know, look, this is 1 Kelvin for the transition temperature. Photoemission still doesn't have this resolution. So it's photoemission, and photoemission on this material is also extremely tough because these are ionic crystals, so the surface are shitty. But photoemission has been done with some results that I don't want to enter. But okay, so my main point is that you clearly see that you go from a phase which is a Mott insulating phase. Here is the gap, which is plotted as a function of temperature, to a metallic phase. So this is an example of this deconfinement transition that I was telling you, where you would go from a Mott insulator phase at small T perp to, let's say, a high dimensional metal at large T perp. And how do you change the T perp? Well, you apply pressure. But of course, when you apply pressure, you're not only changing the T perp, but you change the T parallel, you change everything. So it's very difficult to say here, I just do the theory's dream, which is to keep the T parallel fixed and change the T perp. Okay. But just to say that this is not completely crazy in terms of experiments, here are these energy scales that have been mapped in transport experiment in the group of Denis Jérôme, where you clearly see the gap of the Mott phase going down, and then they have a way that I don't want to discuss here to estimate this crossover scale between the 1D and the 3D regime, and you see clearly this scale going up. So this is something that has grounds in reality, but of course many questions that people don't understand. And you know, you were mentioning what remains to be done in this dimensional crossover question. Look, here below the dimensional crossover, you have a superconducting phase. And clearly, most likely, this has nothing to do with electron-phonon interactions here. This is something driven by electron-electron interactions. So this, you have to understand what is the nature of this phase if you want one day to have a chance to understand, I think, the superconductivity. So this is difficult here to study in a controlled way, because when you apply pressure, you change a lot of things in the compound. So here is where I would say cold atom can come to the rescue, and also prompt for many, many questions, many interesting questions of their own, which is that one can realize, of course, in optical lattices, such quasi one-dimensional systems. And this was done in the group of Tillmann Esslinger in particular. So this is, if you want, an anisotropic version of the beautiful experiment that was done to observe the superfluid to Mott insulator transition from, let's say, a 3D superfluid to a 3D Mott insulator. Here you make the system anisotropic, and you can realize these one-dimensional tubes, which then, by changing the height of the optical lattice here, you can make as much three-dimensional or as much one-dimensional as you like. So this tube will give you the 1D physics, and you can even be nasty, because you can even put an optical lattice along the tube, so you can get a Mott insulator. And of course, you get Josephson coupling, or you get hopping between the tubes, so you get exactly the right system for bosons to study this competition or this deconfinement transition that I was mentioning. So let me again stop with the. So then it's the data. So let me just skip this, and let me just show that something happens in the system. This is again the absorption, the shaking image that I showed you on Monday. And by changing the interaction, something changes in the system. And I want to come back to this later. But first, let me do a pure theorist talk and go back to how one can treat this thing. So again, the point is that with cold atoms, because of the excellent control of that one has over the hopping amplitude, this is an ideal system to tackle this type of questions, because you can vary the T-perp completely independently of the other parameter in the system. So this is really one nice thing. The second thing is that you can do it with bosons instead of fermions, which is also something which is harder to do in condensed matter. If you want to do bosons, you have to do Josephson junction arrays, for example. Okay. Yeah.
I mean, so experimentally, yeah, definitely the advantages. But theoretically, what are the atomic systems offer that's new that has not been worked out in the?
Okay. So, for example, again, the thing which I think would be very interesting would be to do the same thing that was done in the group of Tillmann with fermions. Of course, with fermions, there are all the issues of finite temperature, which need to be seriously lowered before one sees something interesting. But there, the atomic physics is completely different from the, let's say, the organics. And the main reason is the following. And again, it's unfortunately, it's a topic I didn't want to talk about today. But just to give you an idea, the main difference is that in, let's say, solid state physics, the chemical potential is equilibrated everywhere, and therefore the density of particle on one chain is always the same than the density of particle on the other chain, which means that single particle hopping is a relevant perturbation. It's very easy for one fermion to hop from one chain to the other. In the cold atomic physics, you either have, because of the confining potential, or can engineer, if you want, a situation where the KF on one chain is not the same than the KF on the other chain, which means you seriously impair the single particle hopping, and you leave only the particle hole and the particle-particle hopping. So as a result, you get a completely different phase diagram. And one prediction that we have with Miguel and Andrew is that, in particular, in such a situation in cold atoms, one should get a triplet superconductor. While if you were doing the same Hamiltonian, the same thing, in a situation where the KFs are equal, you should get an antiferromagnet. So yes, there are new things that occur, and to some extent for the fermions, the case of the optical lattice is slightly simpler, because you manage to kill the single particle hopping. So as I said, for fermions, I will not talk about it, but I can give you the reference if you want. So this is Miguel Casarina, Andrew Ho, and this is in PRL, where it is 95, 226, 402, and this is 2. So there are, again, two aspects in the, as usual in these games, there are two aspects. You can either view the optical, the atomic system as a model system to try to understand issues you had a hard time understanding in, let's say, the solid state systems. And for example, how this deconfinement transition takes place and so on and so forth. And here it's an incredible system because you can vary T-perp in a totally controlled way without having all the problems of varying the pressure in a solid state system. But also you discover that these systems have their own peculiarities and their own interest. And as I said, for example, for the fermions, the fact that you can get two different KF is a completely new thing that was not, of course, nobody in the condensed matter community had the idea to try to look at a system like this because it's nonsense. Another main difference is the fact that when you do condensed matter, let's say you have spin up and spin down, one with a certain hopping integral, the other with another hopping integral. This is something you can do in optical lattices. It's not something you can do easily in condensed matter. You would need to apply gigantic magnetic field. And so this is another interest. The other thing is that even if you do this in condensed matter, what will you get? You will get two bands like this, but then you will get a single chemical potential for both spin species, which means you will get 4 points at the Fermi surface. Okay. Now, in atomic physics, if you load your system with spin up and spin down, you work with a constant number of spin up and spin down, or isospin up and isospin down, which means that the chemical potential of the two species are not the same. But if you start with 50-50, it means the KF needs to be the same. So this band will adjust itself so that, in fact, at the end of the day, what you will get is a system like this. Okay, I draw poorly, where the KF of the two species have now become, stay the same. Which means that if you think in terms of interactions, there are processes that are allowed here that are forbidden by momentum conservation here. So again, the phase diagram you will get for a system where you say I fix N up and I fix N down is not the same for the system where you say I fix mu up and I fix mu down. And these are interesting issues to explore. Yeah?
Why would KF have to be the same point where the two bands cross? Because
again, you start with a system which has a certain number of particle up and a certain number of particle down. So essentially, the bands are filled up to the KF, to a certain KF. So let me say I put 50% up and 50% down. Okay. And now the only thing I'm saying is that okay, the band is minus T up cosine K, and I get minus T down cosine K minus the chemical potential. Okay? And if you adjust the height of the chemical potential, you will see that this is where you get your Fermi surface. Or if you prefer to draw them not crossing, it doesn't matter. The point is that the KF have to be the same. Okay.
You're not saying that the phase diagram is different if you're in different ensembles.
I am saying the phase diagram is different. I'm saying it's not the same if I put a system which is polarized, which has, not polarized, but which has broken spin rotation symmetry, if I force the chemical potential to be equal, or if I force the number of particles to be equal. It's not just two different ensembles, it's two different physical systems.
In the first case, NF is not equal to NF.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. No, of course, you're right. I'm not claiming that thermodynamic is wrong. If that, we would have published in Nature rather than in PRL, but we just did it in PRL. Okay, so these are issues that people, have to worry when they deal with this type of question. And as I said, for the consequences, it has serious physical consequences. I wish someone would make a system of fermions which has a lower temperature. And again, if the temperature is 1/10 of the Fermi surface, it's probably not good enough. One needs, okay, I hope with the 10 to the minus 3, maybe one can reach that. Again, to give you an idea of the scale in condensed matter, you saw it. The bandwidth of the compound is essentially 6,000 Kelvin. The critical temperature for superconductivity in this material is 1 Kelvin. So this is, again, three or four orders of magnitude between the hopping and the thing. Okay, let me just, the thing I wanted to tell you today is the case of bosons, which an interesting system that, as I said, does not really exist in condensed matter. And that for which we can understand at least reasonably well this deconfinement transition, and for which there are experiments that exist. So if you want more details, you can look at this paper or a more extended paper that was published in a New Journal of Physics 8.158. So this one has all the gory details that you want to do. And if I have time, but probably not, I will tell you one can use the physics that one has understood for this to deduct interesting things for the recent experiment, or not the experiment, but to make a proposal in line with the experiment that was done by Jean Dalibard on the observation of Costelli-Stahlès physics in two-dimensional pancakes. Okay, so what is the question that I want to study? As I said, what I want to study is chains of bosons that have or do not have a periodic potential along the chains, and the bosons are allowed to hop by a certain hopping. So I have an Hamiltonian for the bosons, which is a 1D Hamiltonian on chain alpha, and then I put a hopping like this. Okay. And the 1D Hamiltonian is, of course, something that contains both interactions and that contains eventually a periodic potential. And now the question, so H1D alpha is interacting boson. So this one can give me potentially a Mott insulator, and then I can kill the Mott insulator by going to the 3D system. So this is Josephson coupling. So if you want, it's the match. I don't take questions by phone, but it's the match of Mott versus Josephson. So how does one describe this system? Okay, so everybody has his favorite pet for dealing with interacting boson. My favorite pet is bosonization. So there is a technique that is known as bosonization, which allows to represent excitations of normally what is a fermionic system as sound waves. And the same technique, as was shown by Duncan Haldane in the 80s, can be also applied to a bosonic system. And the idea is quite simple. So this is bosonization of bosons. And maybe I should make a poll. Are you all familiar with this technique or not? No? Yes? Okay, let me just go quick, and the people who want more details can yell at me and stop me. So the idea is very simple. You just represent the single particle operator for the boson at the square root of the density, which is, of course, a function of the position, times a phase, which is the superfluid phase, which is now an operator. And the density you can show, you can also represent in term of a phase. So the density is something like the average density minus the gradient of a certain phase times something, and I'll try to explain what it is, exponential of I to m rho 0 x minus phi of x. So what does it, this complicated, sorry, there is a pi missing here. What is this complicated formula meaning? So this one, I think, requires no explanation. This is just the superfluid phase that you would like to have if you had a function, a wave function for the bosons. And it just tells that now this can depend on position and so on. Now, what this density, this expression for the density means, it means that if you look at the bosons and imagine they form a regular lattice, which they don't, but imagine that they do it, how could you describe the density? The first Fourier component of this is the uniform density. It's the fact that the density will be totally uniform. But now, imagine you displace the bosons by a certain quantity U here, and you compress the bosons. You would make a wave here that goes compressing. So if you average the density at a distance which is larger than the boson spacing, the thing you will see is the divergence of this displacement. It's the standard elasticity term. So you would say, I will correct the density by saying that I get something like grad u here, divergence of u, which in one dimension is the same than a gradient. Because if I made a compression, u will be that way. If I make a dilatation, u will be that way. And this will describe long wavelength variation of the density. But then there is another component, which, sorry?
Time drawn out.
If I take this one times rho naught, if I just replace, I write rho naught times u is a phase, I got my phase. But there is another component, which is to say, okay, now I get this periodic array of bosons, and they form a density wave with a periodicity, which is essentially the average distance between the bosons. But it's not the same if this wave is here, or if this wave is shifted. So again, if I shift everybody by u, I will shift my maxima of the density. So I would like to write that my density is cosine of 2 pi rho 0 x minus u, saying that I've shifted everybody. And this formula is just the generalization of this. So it's a way to decompose the density in Fourier component, which is the uniform one, the long wavelength one, and the higher density wave one. And the point is that phi is an operator. And then if you work out the commutation relation that should exist between bosonic operator, you find that phi of x and grad theta of x prime are conjugate variable. So they obey canonically conjugate relation. And it immediately tells you that then you can build a quantum theory out of it. And if you write the Hamiltonian that you are used into writing, grad psi dagger, grad psi over 2m, plus an interaction, let's say u n square or rho square of x. Musical. More questions, yeah. OK, so let's try to see how this Hamiltonian would look. If I take this formula and I forget that rho depends on x, I will get the gradient of theta here when I differentiate the field here. So this term is essentially rho 0 grad theta square divided by 2m. And this term here is essentially grad phi square times u plus u times grad phi square. So I can reduce the Hamiltonian of an interacting boson system to a quadratic Hamiltonian in the field theta and phi. And because they are canonically conjugate variables, this is a simple harmonic oscillator Hamiltonian. So this is a fantastic technique because you have essentially exactly solved, not exactly, but you have solved the problem of any interacting one-dimensional bosons without the lattice, without the periodic potential. Now, what Haldane showed or discussed in his paper is that this is a stupid perturbative derivation that I've done. But in fact, this remains completely true. And the low energy sector of the system is always described by this Hamiltonian, but now with parameters that depends in a non-simple way of the interaction. So I will get a velocity of excitation, and then I will get another parameter that is the coefficient in front of these two, which is a dimensionless parameter. You can check that it has no dimensions. And this is what is known as the Luttinger parameter. So both u and k depends on the interaction, okay? And then once you have that, you can compute every correlation function you want. So this is a very nice thing because, for example, if I compute the single particle correlation function, you will find that it decays as 1 over x to the power 1 over 2k. If I compute the density correlation function, you will find that, of course, it's rho 0 square. It has a decay, which is essentially 1 over x square times k. And then it has rho 0 cosine 2 pi rho 0 x times 1 over x to the power 2k. So each correlation function decays as a power law, and all the exponents are controlled by this single parameter, which is this Schlödinger liquid parameter. So just to give you an idea of how this parameter varies with the repulsion, so if I take u, when u is equal to 0, which is the free boson, this parameter k is infinite because you want this correlation function not to decay at all. If you have free bosons, you get a Bose condensate if you want, so this should not decay. And if you go... Yeah?
It's a k dimensionless?
Yeah.
But the way it's written now, it's...
No, there are rho 0 and blah, blah, blah.
In the Hamiltonian.
Here?
Theta that phi is a dimensionless as we define.
No, in principle, I think it's the same dimension. Theta has no dimension because it's an exponential. Phi has no dimension because it's an exponential. Okay. And so they have the same dimension. And there are h-bar missings that I'd never write. Right. I take h-bar equals c equal pi equal 1. So that's there are pi's factors also floating here. Okay. And so if you go to the Tonks limit, which is u equal infinity, then this Schlödinger parameter is 1, which immediately tells you that here this correlation will go as 1 over square root of x. So beware when people say at the Tonks limit the bosons are fermions. It's true for their density fluctuations, but it's not true for the single particle wave function, of course, because one is still anti-symmetric and the other is still symmetric. So, but you can easily compute the correlation. So using this representation, you can easily incorporate the interaction. Now, what happens when I want to put the periodic lattice? Well, I just take this formula for the density, and then the thing you will see is that it will couple to the oscillating factor here. And if you have exactly one boson per site, what you do is you will add a term which is g cosine 2 phi. So this is for one boson per site. And so essentially what this term wants to do, it wants to localize the phase phi, which means it wants to turn the system into a Mott insulator where the density will be well defined at each point. And you can work out at which dimension is this operator relevant. And this is a simple matter to compute it. And you will find that at k equal 2, this is when the operator leading to Mott physics will become relevant. So essentially, if you are commensurate, if you are not commensurate, then you get power law decay every time. But if you are commensurate, this is a superfluid phase. And this here would be Mott insulator. So if the interactions are such that the Schlödinger liquid parameter is smaller than 2, then essentially you enter this Mott insulating phase. So this is how one could solve a purely one-dimensional system. So are there questions on that? Or is it,
Can I just check in detail? So in your expression for psi of x, you've got this rho naught to the half of x.
Yeah.
What's the x dependence of rho naught?
This one. Sorry, it's rho. It's the density. It's the density. It's the density.
Okay,
So this is this expression.
Right, and rho naught is just a constant.
And rho naught is just the average, density. So essentially, as for fermions, in 1D you can say that all excitations are these collective excitation, these sound waves of densities that propagate, and because it's 1D, they cannot be completely ordered, and they decay as power law. And using this representation, and using the fact that they fluctuate with harmonic oscillator energies, you can essentially compute very easily this correlation. And again, I want to emphasize, this is a solution of a fully interacting one-dimensional Hamiltonian, and this is also the solution of a system where you have put a periodic lattice, so you can describe the Mott physics. So this is quite powerful technique. Now, if I want to add on the top of this the coupling between the chains, then this is very simple. then what I will do, I will put a sum over alpha here, which is the chain index. This is also, and then I will get minus T perp, and you see that I will have this operator. I will replace rho by rho zero to get the dominant contribution, the most, the leading relevant operator. And then what it gives here is a cosine theta alpha plus 1 minus theta alpha. And this is, of course, sum over alpha and sum over x. So this Hamiltonian described, if you want, this competition between the two tendencies. This cosine wants to the phase phi to be ordered. And this is the Mott insulator. And the coupling between the chains, the hopping of the bosons between the chain, want the phase theta, the superfluid phase, to be ordered. And of course, because they are conjugate variable, they cannot, they do not like to be ordered at the same time. There is a Heisenberg uncertainty principle between them. And so one of these two guys has to win. And essentially, which one will win depends on T perp, and it depends also on the value of the interaction K. So this is a very convenient way to tackle this problem, because you see that you have gotten rid of the difficult part, which is the interaction itself. The interaction is now completely included in this thing. Yeah?
But as you increase T perp, will the bosonization...
Okay, so, absolutely. So this is a very good point. So at which condition am I allowed to do this? Because, of course, if I could always do it, it would be too simple. So the, when is the bosonization approximation valid? So if I have fermions, if I have bosons plus repulsion, you start sort of filling the states here, and you have a chemical potential, which is the 1D chemical potential. If the repulsion is infinite, it's like fermions. This is what Victor told us yesterday. Of course, if the repulsion is zero, this chemical potential is essentially here, because you pile up everybody in K equals zero. But you have a 1D chemical potential. The bosonization is essentially valid for energies which are smaller than this 1D chemical potential. And one crude way of viewing it is that somehow here, if you look at the modes, this is the momentum for phi, field phi. So essentially, this is describing omega square plus k square dispersion. So this is linear dispersion relation. So the bosonization theory tells you that for interacting system, the modes are omega equal uk, where u is the velocity I've written. So you get a linearized, a linear dispersion relation. And this is only valid if you not feel completely the curvature here. So this will, everything that I've said will break down when the energies become larger than this chemical potential. So what you want the T perp to be smaller than this 1D chemical potential. And of course, remember that this is also a function of the interaction. So in particular, if I let the interaction become very small, this will go down, 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 and then there will be a regime where I cannot view my system as weakly coupled one-dimensional chains. But it's better to start from an isotropic system. So I want to be in this regime, so to say that I have a system which is made of weakly coupled 1D chains. If not, you have to start from an isotropic system and then put the interaction the way you can and whatever. But if I am in this regime, then I am safe. So this is a good technique to tackle, I would say, reasonably interacting bosons. If you are with very weakly interacting bosons, you're probably much better off starting with Gross-Pitayevsky or theories like that. Because, yeah.
Yeah. So you put in a hopping. But what about Coulomb interaction? There's also cosine between.
Not in cold atoms. Okay. Not in cold atoms. In if it was condensed matter, or then you would have to put in particular, you would have to put additional terms like grad phi, which would be the simplest density coupling, and also cosine phi, absolutely. But that's another advantage of cold atomic physics. The interactions are zero range. I mean, or extremely short range. So there is absolutely no interaction, unless you make a system with dipole, and you have to work very hard to make long range interactions in these systems. So if you don't work very hard, then this is really what there is, and you don't have to worry about other cosine density correlations. Yeah. So that's one thing. Okay, so let me just before embarking on the question of the competition between mod physics and just tell you what happens if I don't put the mod potential. Because after all, this is a very simple problem, which is coupled bosonic chains, and I should recover my 3D superfluid. Okay, so I just take coupled bosonic chains, I put a T-perp here, and the question is, how do I get my 3D ordered superfluid? And essentially, you see what happens. You have an Hamiltonian again, which is this pi alpha square. Okay, so let me do it differently. So let me integrate here. If I don't have this cosine, I can integrate over the field phi. And if I write an action, what I will get is an action for the field theta, which is this one, dx theta square, and there will be a k here. And then I just have minus t perp cosine theta alpha plus 1 minus theta alpha. So this is a very simple Hamiltonian that we all know and love. And there are now many ways that one can deal with this Hamiltonian. The simplest is to do mean field and to say, OK, I want to describe a transition between, as a function of, let's say, temperature, between a normal phase to a superfluid, 3D superfluid, at certain critical temperature. So what I will do, I will just write this as T perp exponential of I theta alpha plus 1 and do the mean field exponential of minus I theta alpha, which gives me an effective hopping. And then I have to solve, of course, self-consistently. And what I have to deal with now is a theory, which is this one, which is very nice because it's the Sine-Gordon theory, and we know everything there is to know about the Sine-Gordon theory. So essentially, then you have to write the self-consistency equation, which is that T effective is equal to T perp average of cosine theta with a full Hamiltonian here. And you can do it, and I will pass the details. But what I want to give you are the interesting consequences that one finds. The first thing that one finds is at T equals 0, what is the condensate fraction? So if I compute the condensate fraction, what you will find is that this is essentially T perp to a power which is 1 over 8k minus 2. So contrarily to what you would get in a standard isotropic superfluid, here you see that the condensate fraction of this system is a strong function of the T-perp. Because, of course, if you were killing the T-perp, this would be a 1D problem which would have no condensate fraction. So it has to go to 0 when T-perp goes to 0. And this condensate fraction is now renormalized or changed by the interaction along the chains. And if you work out numbers corresponding to, for example, Tillmann's experiment, you can reach numbers which are about 20% of what you would get if of the total density of the system. So this is a strong reduction of the condensate fraction by quantum fluctuations.
This is 3D.
Yeah. This is 3D. I never write the 3D system, but this is a 3D.
No, but I just meant on your diagram, you're starting at low temperature.
So. Yeah, here would be the zero temperature condensate fraction. Yeah, this is the zero temperature. Okay. Now, if you want the TC, then it's essentially the same that the TC will go as T perp to the power 1, that's 2 minus 1 over 2k. And let me get back this. So again, the TC is also renormalized by the interaction. So again, this is something that is quite reasonable. If T perp was 0, the TC would have to go to 0 because there is no ordered state in one dimension. So the fact that you get a TC is strongly dependent on the fact that you get a T perp, and the exponent that you get here is dependent on the interactions you get in the chains. Yeah.
So if this was 2D instead, then you wouldn't expect to have any condensate.
No, then you would have. Then you could not use the mean field theory in such a stupid way. So the fact that you can use the fact that these results are obtained using mean field theory is, of course, sort of hoping that in 3D the mean field theory treating this. Coupling here in mean field is not a too bad approximation. If you had a 2D, you would need to solve this Hamiltonian in a much cleaner way to remember that you still get unbounded fluctuations for the system. But this is still a very reasonable Hamiltonian to solve, if any, numerically, for example. I'll come to what this Hamiltonian is. You didn't realize it, but this is coupled XY planes to some extent. Okay, at that level you realized it, but I will make it even worse in a moment. You're controlling the coupling. So this is 2D XY.
No, but you're controlling the width, right? You're controlling the length of one of the dimensions of the...
Not the length. You're controlling the coupling.
No, the length, I mean, as a function of temperature, with temperature.
Sorry, which no. With temperature, yes. So with temperature, No, I see what you mean now. With temperature, you're controlling the size in the imaginary time. Absolutely. I agree with
that's
that.
How you're getting
absolutely. I agree with that. Yeah. Okay. So the point I want to make here is that there are strong change compared to the, of course, what you would get from an isotropic system, because all the condensate fraction, the critical temperature, are strongly renormalized by the quantum fluctuation that you get. Now, one question one could ask is whether this phase here is about the simple 3D superfluid that you would get by doing, let's say, Gross-Pitayevsky, or whether there are still some differences. Because I would say the first idea is that this would be the simple 3D superfluid, and I think it's true. But I just want to point out one interesting difference compared to what you would get when you do Gross-Pitayevsky. And this interesting difference comes when you try to look at the modes that exist in this system. I should not erase the Hamiltonian, but okay. I put it in the middle, which was a bad idea. So let me now try to look at the modes, the eigenmodes that one had in the system. And because one has such a simple Hamiltonian, computing the modes inside the superfluid is something which is doable. And again, I don't want to enter into the details on how one do it, but this is standard procedure. You do essentially RPA, you do fluctuations around the saddle point, and blah, 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 blah. Okay, yeah?
Can you just add, if you're at, I thought if you're at finite temperature, you take some critical value of T perp to couple these.
No.
No, for 1D, if they're really 1D.
No. If they are coupled in a 3D lattice, it doesn't take a critical value. As soon as you will put a T perp, if the temperature is small enough, you will get another
temperature. But let's say you start out in the
That's what I. That's what I'm saying. If for a given value of T perp there is a TC, so if I was plotting it as a function of T perp, I would stay 1D for a while, and then I would order at a certain critical value of T perp. So you can view this relation two ways. This is giving you the TC for a fixed T perp, or if you invert, it gives you the critical T perp for a fixed temperature. So you'd need a critical value.
Could you draw the diagram with T on the vertical axis and perp on the horizontal?
Sure. So if you have T perp here and you want the temperature, what do you want, the TC? Or temperature here. So if T perp is equal to zero, TC is equal to zero. And then you have this curve, which, okay, I will not try to draw an exponent, but it's a curve, let's say, something like this. And then essentially, if I am at temperature here, I'm, let's say, normal, which means essentially 1D, uncoupled or weakly coupled chains. And here I'm, let's say, 3D superfluid. Okay, so that's the phase diagram you would get here. And again, remember here, I didn't put the Mott potential. I didn't put the periodic potential. So the system is, let's say, incommensurate, but it's not a Mott potential. Okay, so let me just comment on the modes. When you do the calculation for this system of the modes you get, what you get is a mode which is omega square equal essentially k square plus K perp square. So you're very happy of that because this is the Goldstone mode that you expect in a superfluid. So K parallel is along the chains. Sorry, I'm going too fast. And let me now say K perp is the degree of freedom perpendicular to the chain. So I'm just taking this Hamiltonian and I just want to know what is the excitation spectrum. So if I was purely 1D, then this would give me an omega square, this would give me a k parallel square. So if I go to real time, I would get a resonance when omega square equal k parallel square, which tells me I have linear dispersion relation. Now here I have transverse degree of freedom, so I have to do the Fourier transform with a certain vector k perp to get it as a function of the wave vector along the perpendicular direction. And because I am in a superfluid, I expect to have a Goldstone mode where I can change the phase uniformly in the system. And you see clearly that this Hamiltonian, if I rotate all the phases, is invariant. So there is indeed a Goldstone mode, and you do find it.
There is it before the mean field approximation, you just...
This is, you have to expand properly around the mean field, and okay, there are good techniques to do this. There is another technique that I don't want to mention, which is to use a variational approach. So you try to find what is the best quadratic Hamiltonian that approximates this Sine-Gordon Hamiltonian, and this gives you the mode. So you're very happy you get the Goldstone mode. And then the point which is interesting is that you find another mode, which is a gapped mode. Plus f of k here. And now you could say we were very happy when we found these modes, because we said this one is the phase mode and this one is the amplitude mode. So this is the fluctuation of the phase and this is fluctuation of the amplitude. Okay, so if I take my order parameter, I will write it as psi 0 plus an amplitude times exponential of a phase, and then I would say if I try to shift to let the phase fluctuate, it doesn't cost a lot of energy, but if I try to let the amplitude fluctuate, it costs a lot of energy. And so this was very reasonable to find these two modes. The only catch is that if you do Gross-Pitayevsky, you find only one mode.
This is an would be exactly true in a translationally invariant system where you're allowed only one mode at zero temperature. There is no amplitude mode. That would be
in Gross-Pitayevsky.
Yeah. Well, actually, in a translationally invariant system, in a Galilean invariant system, you can show that there can be only one mode at zero temperature. There is second sound at finite temperature, but here there is broken translation.
Exactly.
So that is exactly what allows you
exactly. Amplitude. Exactly. The other thing is that in Gross-Pitayevsky, you get only one mode because also the dynamics is different. So essentially, the main point is that in Gross-Pitayevsky, the term that you write to describe the dynamic is a first-order derivative. And essentially, when you put both, what you find is that this pushes this mode, this amplitude mode, into a continuum where it becomes overdamped and goes away.
But basically, you impose a Galilean invariance because this equation is Galilean invariant.
Yeah. No, I agree with that. Okay, that's another way of formulating it if you want. The point is that here, this dynamic is Lorentz invariant. You get second order, so you get dt psi square. If you want dispersion, whereas here this one is only first order, and therefore this, okay, so Ehud was saying Galilean invariance, I would say compared to this thing, this corresponds to a damping of this mode. So this mode, in fact, is increased in energy. If you try, for example, to put both terms in the action, you will find that it just pushes this mode high in energy, and then this mode goes away, yeah.
Is this I in which time?
This is real time, yeah. This is real time. Yeah, this is real time. Okay, so I just want to point out this thing because that's the main difference, I would say, that this low temperature superfluid phase has compared to a standard, I would say, isotropic 3D superfluid. The rest is quite normal. You get a condensate fraction, you get, you know, a broken symmetry, and so on and so forth.
So can I ask, but,
yeah.
When you write down this TC, is this really the coupling where the coupling temperature when the cosine becomes relevant?
It's
the principal cosine can become relevant, but it's still
no,
be higher than
no, the no, 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 no. It's not no no. You have to distinguish two things. The cosine becomes relevant as a function of k, which is the strength of the interaction. So the cosine is relevant for values of k which are larger than 1/4. Okay? And then this is the temperature at which this coupling can give the broken symmetry. this is not, if, of course, if the cosine here was irrelevant, you would get no chance of getting it, whatever the temperature, even at T equals zero.
Right.
But then at finite temperature, because as you said, you limit the size of the system, you need, it's not because the operator is relevant that it can break the symmetry. So this is the temperature at below which the symmetry breaking takes place. Okay.
Oh, I see. You would then run your, it's relevant, it's growing.
It's growing.
Until it gets
exactly.
Enough.
Exactly. Exactly.
Second here.
Sorry, not in stereo. Sorry. Yeah. Yeah. Go ahead.
How do you see this second sound mode or whatever here in this?
You mean how we derive it?
Yeah. In this action you wrote down.
This one,
yeah.
It's quite hairy. I can show you the calculation, but essentially the idea is that you do the mean field. It's a standard technique. So you do the mean field with another parameter here that now you allow to fluctuate in space and time. Then you integrate over the bosons and write a quadratic or a Ginzburg lambda action for your space and time dependent order parameter. And then you look at the modes that this action is giving you. And you can do it because you can integrate explicitly the correlation functions for the Sine-Gordon theory. This is standard RPA technique, if you want, or expansion around the saddle point to get the thing. So you get essentially a 2x2 matrix, which corresponds to the correlation of exponential of I theta and exponential of plus or minus I theta. In the normal phase, you get only the minus correlation that survives. But in the broken symmetry phase, both correlation survives, and this gives you the two modes. So that's the way you get it.
You get an effective action that
yeah.
has another
square term. You get an effective action that has these two modes as eigenvalues. And this is the equivalent of what you would write by writing an effective Ginzburg-Landau equation, except you know the coefficients. And you can also write by hand the Ginzburg-Landau equation.
But the Ginzburg-Landau equation near this transition
yeah.
perp going to zero, basically.
At small t perp, yeah.
So
a small t perp.
Yeah. Between the 1D disordered phase and the
3D. Yeah, and where the psi fluctuates in amplitude between this thing. Yeah. Okay, so let me stop for the system without the mod potential and just tell you, because I think I'm running dangerously over time here, about what happens when one puts the mod potential. And now it becomes a much more uncontrolled situation, because you see that Gesundheit, because you see that essentially you have this competition between the two cosines here. So how do you treat these objects where one cosine wants to have phi ordered and one cosine wants to have theta ordered? So there are we use a variety of technique. None of them is perfect. It would be, by the way, interesting to have maybe numerics done on this system. So I can tell you what we did. We did renormalization group equations, which is to say, let's try to see how this. What is the effective Hamiltonian at large length scale that control the problem? And the problem here is that you find that both operators are relevant. So essentially you get something like this, that the coupling constant for the mod potential wants to grow, and the coupling constant for the interchain coupling wants to grow. So you get something like this. And now I would forget the dimension of the other one, which is 1 over 2k times t perp. You get term here in addition. And what is important is you get the equation for this one, which looks like this. So you change the scale in the problem, and you see what happens. This one wants to grow and drive the system towards a mod insulator if k is smaller than 2. So if the interaction is such that k is smaller than 2, j is relevant. Now, this one wants to grow and want to drive the system towards coupled chain, and it's relevant if k is larger than 1/4. And k itself is pulled on both directions. So this one wants to make k larger to be more and more relevant. And this one wants to make k smaller to be more and more relevant itself. And they compete. But the problem is that you get two strong coupling fixed points, so it's very difficult to control the RG. So we were crude, and we said the following. We said, okay, the phase which is realized is whichever becomes one or for the one first. And this is a rule of thumb, if you want, to say, okay, if this one reaches a coupling of order one before this one, most likely it will dominate the Hamiltonian and give you a phase, which is the motif. Oh yeah, there is Jose Kadanoff Nelson. They don't do much more on this question. Okay, there are various issues here. So here it's slightly more complicated for two reasons. The first one is couple different chains. And the model they considered was something with, of course, a double Sine-Gordon model. You're right. I'm not disagreeing with what you're saying. I'm just saying the model they considered is this one. And I'll come to this one in a second. So this is a dual Sine-Gordon model with, I'm saying here you also get the coupling between the different chains and different 1D Hamiltonian, which is slightly complicated. But if you do mean field on this one, you fall down exactly on this problem. And then there is the value of P here. So you have three cases. You have one case which is trivial, where the two operators are relevant in two separate cases. This is absolutely trivial. Only one is important. Then you have the more subtle case where they touch. And this is a problem we solved with Einschulz in whatever, 87 or something like this. It's here, it's nice because since they touch, you can do a control RG around that point. And then you have the problem which interests us here, which is the case where they are relevant simultaneously. And this is a nasty region. And I looked, of course, in this paper, there were also more recent work by Le Cheminon, Ercesian, and other people on double Sine-Gordon model. But it's not easy to determine the phase of this system. There was also a recent work by Fertig on this problem, where he claimed that there was an intermediate phase that appeared in between. I think, in any case, it doesn't apply to our case for the reason I was saying, that here it correspond to coupling of the chain. There is a lot of activity on this dual Sine-Gordon model, and again, I don't think the final word on them has been said yet. So as I said, here we use a crude criterion, and if you take this crude criterion, you see exactly what happened. When T-perp is very small, you get the Mott insulating phase, and when T-perps become larger, at some point this one will dominate and you get the thing. So this is a way to get the transition as a function of T-perp from a Mott insulator to coupled chains.
Can you do variational theory?
No. The problem with variational theory is that it's a Gaussian expansion around, let's say, minima of phi. But this operator creates solitons. And so the Gaussian theory is an extremely bad approximation to get the correlation function. So Gaussian theory works when you have only the cosine of one of the phase. But if you put the cosine of the two phases, it's known that it's, for example, one could benchmark it with this system. It's an extremely bad starting point. Yeah.
Actually, I'm having the same thing myself in a different problem. But even when the subtle system approximation is good for the energy and the effect, is it guaranteed to be good for the correlation?
Okay, a variational method is never guaranteed to be good.
Yeah.
It's
but from the experience,
you know, it worked for BCS. It's not bad. No, so it's never guaranteed. But essentially, once you have, let's say, a cosine here, it's quite reasonable to imagine that fluctuations around the minima of the cosine will be a sort of faithful description of the physics of the system. And we did it even for disordered system where you get coupling with a random phase here and whatever. And by benchmarking to known solution, it's an excellent description of the system. But you can easily do it in a very simple way. Do the self-consistent theory for Sine-Gordon. It essentially amounts in replacing the cosine by m phi square. And then try to compute the correlation function exponential of I theta, exponential of minus I theta. It gives you zero. Zero, zero, zero. At all distance, all time, blah, blah, blah. Okay, not exactly, but
for replacing cosine phi or cosine theta?
No, for replacing cosine phi by phi square.
Right.
And the reason is that this guy creates kinks. And if you have a periodic potential like this, creating a kink taking you from there to there doesn't cost any energy or very little energy, just the energy of passing the barrier. But if now it's phi square, you kick the system at an incredibly high energy, and this kills completely this correlation function. So I don't know, we played a lot with Pierre Ledoussal in trying to improve this variational approach to try to put the kinks in it, and so far we didn't go, we didn't reach any good thing. But it works beautifully if you're having a single cosine and are interested in the correlation function of the same phase. That I can, it's not, you know, guaranteed, but it's, over experience, it worked very well. But here we are defenseless. So okay, so it gives this so we use this rule of thumb. It gives this transition. So at least it's a way to get this transition, and it gives a critical value. For example, that T perp is the coefficient of the cosine with an exponent, which would be this one. So this is not really important, but at least just to say that we can get it. So this was a little bit frustrating not to have a better thing. So we wanted to do it two ways. The first, because of course the question you want to ask is what is the nature of this transition, even if it's not very relevant for the cold atoms, because it's not a question of determining the critical behavior here, more to know what are the phases. But essentially, you know, you would like to know whether it's a continuous transition, whether there are two transitions or whatever. So there is one trick one can use, which is to take a special value, which is go to k equal 1/2. And if you go to k equal 1/2, then you can show that this Hamiltonian can be mapped onto a spin system. And the system is the following. This object becomes Heisenberg Hamiltonian. This object is a staggered field in the z direction. So it's like g minus 1 to the I sz. And this object, if you do mean field, so this one, would be a staggered field in the x direction. And so now you're in good business, because what you can do on your spin Hamiltonian is to rotate the axis. It's like putting a field in the x direction, a field in the z direction. It's like putting the field along a certain direction. So you do the rotation on the spin. The kinetic energy, I mean the spin-spin interaction, is invariant by rotation. This is why you need this special value k equal 1/2. And then it's like applying a field along the z direction. So you can bring back this Hamiltonian onto a simple Sine-Gordon model. And that allows you to solve fully. So for k equal 1/2, if one does mean field, one can get a full solution. No, no, for cold atoms it's useless. But at least, you know, the RG doesn't tell you that anything nasty happens when you go from, let's say, k equal 1.2 to k equal 1/2. So we could hope that if this solution was giving that this is a continuous transition, it would carry out for the interesting value of k. As I said, for interesting value of k, the only real method we have is this one. But at least we satisfied ourselves by going to this unreasonable value of k, of the fact that the transition was continuous and that there was not some intermediate phase or something like this in between. Okay, so that's the thing I can say. Another argument I can give for the fact that the transition is continuous, you know, I think it's Feynman who said if you have several arguments, it means that you don't have a really good argument. So, as I said, I think this transition is not yet fully understood, and I'm just giving you the things we try to do to try to attack it. I would say at the level of cold atoms, the only thing that really counts are the phases. And the prediction here is quite clear. One should get a transition from a Mott insulating phase to, let's say, a superfluid at a certain value of the T-perp. So this is the thing. Now, as people liking to play with quantum criticality, you would, of course, like to know whether this transition is continuous, what are the critical exponents, and so forth. So let me give you a final argument, which you might like or not like, which is the following, and which is something we used for this question of 2D XY model that I don't want to, that I won't have time to tell you in detail, but let me just mention it. This Hamiltonian here, with the cosine phi, is exactly the 2D XY model. So let me make the statement here. So if I have an Hamiltonian which is grad phi square plus grad theta square minus g cosine 2 phi, this is 2D xy model. Okay, let me put it that way in quotes, because this is 2D xy model for the phase theta. And the reason is the following. This is the naive expansion you would get. So if I take the action, this is the time derivative of theta. So this is the expansion you would get from a classical model by expanding the phase in the two directions. So one direction would be the space, and one direction would be the imaginary time, and you would get grad theta along x, grad theta along time. Now you know that in the 2D xy model you have vortices that can be generated in the phase, and this operator is exactly the operator that generates the vortices. So this full Sine-Gordon Hamiltonian can be mapped onto a 2D classical xy model for the phase theta. Okay? Now if I look at what is the term T perp, it's just the coupling of this phase theta between quote planes. So essentially, if I have an array of lines, so these are quantum lines, quantum 1D lines, I can map this problem onto a plane, an array of planes, each plane being 2D xy and being coupled by a cosine theta minus cosine theta thing. So this is essentially now, this would be a 3D xy model, anisotropic 3D xy. So the thing I'm claiming is that this Hamiltonian is the 4D xy model, is the anisotropic 4D xy model. So what I'm claiming is that what we have written here is 4D xy model with anisotropy. And then there is a good deal we know about the 4D xy model, because, you know, dynamical exponent, critical exponent, all this can be determined because this is above the upper critical dimension. And when you work out the exponent, you find that it fits quite nicely with the one we got for the exact solution. So I don't want to enter into the details, but essentially the fact that the critical, the condensate fraction would grow as the distance to the transition. So here you would find that the condensate fraction here, psi square, is growing as T perp minus T perp critical. And this is also what you find when you take this special value k equal 1/2. So if you want, this is a microscopic solution. This is more doing criticality on the 4D xy model, but this fits. So okay, so we are sort of happy with the fact that one gets a continuous solution, and that this solution is indeed some transition between the Mott insulator and the coupled chains. I won't have time, because I think it would be totally unreasonable to tell you about, but because this system of 1D quantum chains maps onto coupled two-dimensional planes, this is something which is very useful in trying to make connection with this recent experiment that was done by Jean Dalibard at the École Normale, where they had an optical lattice and sliced pancakes and used it to study the Costalis-Starless transition. So I won't have time to tell you about that, but if you're interested, I just want to give you the reference where you can find the where did I put the reference? That's a good question. Where you can find more details on how to use this for this experiment.
Two coupled eigenmodels, that would be what you said.
Sorry?
With a cosine 2 phi, that gives you two coupled.
This one?
Two coupled eigenmodels.
No, this one is exactly the 2D classical XY model. And this is the vortices of the 2D XY model. Okay. So yeah, sure, let me just write the reference and then I'm all yours. So this is... And this is on CONMAT 0701761. Yeah, Sorry, what was your problem?
In our technical question, we said that there is an SV2 invariant point at which k is equal to 1/2.
Yes.
But I would think that the dimension of g and t perfect is the same. When I look at the RG equation, that all the same.
No, this is the representation of SZ for a spin chain. And if I take this one with p equal 1, this is the representation of SX for a spin chain. And the reason, this is true regardless of what is k. What is not true regardless of what is k is that this part is the isotropic Heisenberg model. So in general, if k is not equal to 1/2, then this is an anisotropic model, which means that then I cannot make the rotation to bring the magnetic field in one direction.
So what I'm just surprised that when k is 1/2, I think it's anisotropic, which means dimension of g and t perp should be the same.
Yeah.
And you have our g equations over there, and I look at them, like if k equals 1/2, and I don't see that they're the same.
No, they should.
Well, I get 3/2 for g and 1/2.
They should. It's just that I screwed up. Ah, no, but wait. I know why. Because these are for the coupled thing, not for the mean field theory.
Ah, okay.
Let me check the dimensions. No, it works. And the SZ and the SX have the same dimension at k equal 1/2. There is no problem about that. Let me check that I didn't do a mistake in writing the exponent. But where are they? Yeah, that's the problem in writing on the board. 2 minus k. No, I think there is no... No, so this is correct. But I think the point is that this is twice the exponent because of the two chains. Okay, we can discuss this, and it works. No problem. Okay, so this is essentially what we got. Now, how could we compare this with the experiments? And the problem is that it's difficult to compare with the experiments that were done by Tillman. But at least. Okay, there are good things and bad things. The bad things, I think, is that this experiment would need to be done in a much more quantitative way, in the sense that it was more a proof of realization of the model, and then, they moved to fermions, and that was it. But let me at least show you what exists. And when this thing will start. The second problem in the experiment is the confining potential, which of course makes it difficult to get a Mott insulating phase. And as we discussed on Monday, it's not clear at all that they got a Mott insulating phase in this system. Okay. Okay, so again, to remind you, they have these tubes. They put an optical lattice along the tube, and they can change the barrier here between the tubes. So here is the prediction we would have for the phase diagram, and this is exactly what I told you. This is the Schlottinger parameter here that correspond to the repulsion. So here is weakly repulsive Bose gas. Here is strongly repulsive Bose gas. K equal 1 is the Tonks limit. Gamma is essentially the repulsion written for the Lieb-Leninger model. Just to give you a scale, and this is essentially the transverse hopping. Forget this; I don't want to talk about it. But essentially, using the RG, one can get this phase diagram here, where you would go from the 1D Mott insulator to this anisotropic 3D superfluid. Okay, and this is this deconfinement transition that we were discussing about. Okay, now. Essentially, here is what is measured on the system that Tillman group was doing in this experiment by Stoffele and collaborator. So they can, depending on the height of their optical lattice, they can go from a purely 1D regime, where the barriers are extremely large, to a totally isotropic 3D regime, where essentially the optical lattice has the same strength in all direction. And then essentially their main probe is this shaking of the lattice. And you see that, okay, when they change the repulsion, things happen between a phase which has a broad absorption and a phase which has peaks. And we discussed on Monday, it's not very clear that this doesn't mean MOT insulator because of the presence of the second peak in U. So it's very difficult to say. This is what they said in the paper, but I'm not sure I agree with that, that this is the superfluid and this is the MOT insulating phase. Okay. Now here is the intermediate region where the system has a 1D to 3D crossover. And again,
they change
J-perp. So this is very large, very small J-perp. This is J-perp equal J-parallel, and this is J-perp equal a small fraction of J-parallel.
That phase bond, that was at fixed finite temperature.
This is here written for the zero temperature system. So this is the quantum phase transition, if you want. Okay. Now you can decide for yourself, and again, if the interpretation here that this is MOT insulator and this is superfluid is correct, you clearly see a transition here occurring, and you would like to say this is this deconfinement transition. But as I pointed out on Monday, this phase is also incommensurate. So it's a little bit unclear to know whether this thing which is observed here is just the broadening of the peak merging and giving you a broad absorption, or whether they have observed a true transition. Here is what they see for the coherent fraction. And you clearly see that the coherent fraction, when they increase the repulsion, is going down as a function of the repulsion. And it's going down in very different ways, depending on whether you're 3D, 1D, 3D, or 1D. So in 1D, essentially, the half width is always quite large. So this goes well with the fact that you would not get a condensate. In 3D, you get a very narrow peak, which then is followed by something which is much broader. So this is where you would like to put the 3D, let's say, MOT to superfluid transition. And now you could say that here, in the intermediate case, you have again a transition between something that is a superfluid and something that is a non-superfluid, that is again something which is disordered. Again, as I said, that's the best I can do to make the comparison with the experiment. I think what would be really needed here is an experiment that would simply track what is the condensate fraction as a function of T-perp to try to check whether indeed one has or not this deconfinement transition. So far with the existing data, I think beauty is in the eyes of the beholder, and you can either view it. It's consistent with the things we predict, but I would be hard pressed to tell that this is either a proof or something drastically convincing. The second thing is the way they fitted the peak here. They fitted it to a Gaussian distribution, which means that even in one dimension, you see that they have a condensate fraction. And we know that in one dimension, there shouldn't be any condensate fraction. So this is, I think, something that would need to be improved and to be fitted with a proper distribution in order to carefully distinguish when one has really a true condensate and when one has just this power law diverging condensate that one has in one dimension. I think at the moment the only thing one can say is that what they measured here is an upper bound for what the condensate fraction should be. Okay, so that's more or less the situation. As I said, unfortunately, now they have moved to fermions, so I think either another group would have to take over and trying to repeat or do this experiment in a more controlled way, or as I mentioned, this is something, the same technology that one developed can also be used potentially to tackle the question of this coupled 2D classical pancake. Essentially, you can view each classical pancake as 1D quantum chains, and perhaps the group of Jean Dalibard will be able to probe part of this physics. So here is just a slide showing you what they had done for the Costales Taules. I think, Ehud, you will talk about that probably tomorrow. Yeah. So the only point I want to make is that this experiment is also a way to probe this physics without the MOT potential, but this is also a way to probe this physics of coupled one-dimensional chains.
It's completely classical.
Yeah, but again, the fact that it's classical is not a problem because the operator creating the vortices is the same than the one that was creating the MOT potential that was responsible for the MOT phase in the quantum system. So again, this problem, if you allow tunneling between the planes, is exactly the problem I discussed before in another language. So this is exactly the a good system, and hopefully a system that exists and continue to exist on which this issue could be tackled. Okay, I think I will stop here. I've been okay. It's the regular 2 hours, I would say, a seminar. I hope to have at least convince you that there is some interesting issue to tackle in this coupled low-dimensional systems, and that cold atomic systems are, I would say, good candidates to understand this physics. Thank you for your attention. Yes?
Basically, it sounds like a general existential question, which is like, what is, as theorists, can we hope to do with this system? So it's a couple, a weakly coupled Armstrong XY model, and I mean, presumably a lot's been done.
Yeah.
What hope is
there? Okay, so as I said, again, it depends also on your personal focus. I would say for the bosons, a lot of things are under control, but you see that we still don't have. There was still debate on whether this double Sein-Gordon, for example, Hamiltonian, would have an intermediate phase between the Mott insulator and the superfluid. So, from that point of view, the debate was not closed. So, I would say there are still things to do. As you said, it's coupled or anisotropic XY models, but here the interesting thing is that you want to study it as a function of the anisotropy. It's not just that you put a small anisotropy and you vary the temperature and you're not too much worried about the anisotropy. Oh, it's irrelevant. You drive the system where to a point where the fact that it's anisotropic will seriously matter. So you want to be in the weakly coupled regime. And again, you cross over from 2D physics to 3D physics. So I don't think this is understood. Now, I think the real question lies, or not the real question, but much more difficult questions, lies when you put fermions instead of bosons. The good point here is that the hopping of the particle between the chains has a mean field. If you want, there is something like the average of a boson operator. So all in all, you write your psi dagger psi as average of psi dagger times psi, and okay, give or take a couple of exponents and things like this, it's more or less okay. If you have fermions, this object does not exist. And there is no way you're going to treat the hopping in any kind of mean field theory. And there the game is completely open. And I think, as a theorist, this is where the really hard part lies. This also is probably good for numerics. If you do fermions, you know you get sign problem, and you get much more serious issues. Yeah.
Just one comment on this Dalek-Barrett system. Perhaps it's not such a good system to study this crossover because it also has the issue that it's very, very elongated. So there is what takes in, there is also 2D to 1D crossover that comes in. So I think it might be a very messy system.
Again, you might be right. They might also change the experiment to make it a good system to study. That the answer can only come from them, I would say. I would say potentially they have, with their system, something that can allow to tackle this question in a slightly different way than the group of Tillmann had. I say had because now their tubes are loaded with fermions. So unfortunately, I don't think they will continue playing with the bosons. But this might be an alternative, or another group might do the coupled tubes with the bosons. But yeah.
I mean, these, if I just does mean field both are modeling, mm-hmm. and I go from the lower dimensions to high dimensions, I get trivially dimensional crossover, or like a quality coupling. Now all of Tillmann's results have been completely consistent with mean field theory. I couldn't see any 1D correlations in your samples because probably the resolution was too bad.
Resolution was bad, resolution was bad, and also I think at the time when they wrote the paper, they were probably not, let me say that way, using the right tool to fit, for example, the N of K and things like this. So again, I agree with you. This is something that the existing experiment of Tillmann should serve as a base now to do an experiment looking for this type of effects.
But what exactly will be the feature which mean field does not predict?
Okay, mean field, yeah, mean field does not predict. For example, if you start from a purely isotropic system, mean field get wrong all the energy scales. Like, for example, the critical temperature, the condensate fractions. These are, as you saw, powers of T-perp with an exponent that depends on the interaction. So, for example, if you started from an isotropic or weakly anisotropic Bose-Hubbard model, you would not get that. You would get something which is some number, and you would not get the quantum depletion that you can get from the fact that you get strong 1D fluctuation. So that's one. The second thing which might or might not be able easy to probe are these modes, for example. But that, I think it would also occur in a 2D system. So the main point is the existence of the quantum fluctuations, the fact that the energy scales are completely different, and the fact that also in the normal phase, as I said, you would get a peak and N of K, which is completely different from what a standard mean field model would describe. So that's what I would. But again, I agree that it's a little bit unfortunate that you know this line of experiment could not be pursued independently of this, simply because this was a very interesting system to look at. Yeah.
So in the experiment, there is always a harmonic trap, you know.
Yeah.
So what are the theorists going to do?
What are the theorists going to do about it? Cry, bang their head on the wall. Yeah, yeah. So I totally agree with you. So what we tried to do about this here, and this is the part I didn't want to talk about here, is to view the trap as giving a finite size of the system. So that's the crudest effect of the trap. And then this gives additional parts in the phase diagram. But sorry? You could try to do LDA. The main problem is that, of course, with the trap, the question of being commensurate or incommensurate is screwed up. So maybe this is, as I said, going to a system which is in fact a classical system here might be a better way, because then you suffer less from this question of commensurability, because now the operator that was only existing at commensurability for the quantum system is the operator creating vortices in the classical system, so that's less of a problem. So I would say the answer is A, either find other systems, or B, do numerics, which is at the moment, or LDA, but this is very difficult to do when you have to deal with these questions. Yeah.
But there's this work by Paredes where they fermionized the system, and then they were able to take into account the trap.
No, you can take into account the trap. I'm not saying you cannot take into account the trap. You go to the Tonks limit, you can do things. I'm just saying if you want to deal with a generic interaction, which is not exactly at the Tonks point, okay. You know, I can deal with the trap with some approximation. But then, for example, if I do this Hartree-Fock approximation, I get regions where the density is going very small, so I cannot use the bosonization method anymore, and things like that. So there are complications, but that's also a part of the interest in the problem. Sorry, you had also a question.
Yeah. So, is it correct that the phase where the interchain coupling becomes strong and this period potential becomes strong simultaneously? So. Is this phase the phase where the...
You mean, can one have a phase where both operator would be relevant at the same time?
Yeah.
I would say, okay, that's a very good question. And the honest answer is this would be probably what people would call a super solid, where you would get both something which wants to order the density and something which wants to give you some kind of superfluid order parameter. I would say if I trust... an honest answer is I don't know the answer to this question.
Most likely is that this boson becomes insulating in the chain direction.
Yeah.
Becomes perforating in the chain direction. So it becomes...
I see what you would like. You would like to have a kind of decoupled 2D planes where I think here in this weakly coupled limit, this will not happen. because essentially the interchain coupling is much smaller than the kinetic energy along the chains. So essentially, at least it doesn't seem to occur in the various method like this solution at k equal 1/2 and whatever. Maybe this happens in a more isotropic system or in a, but here it seems that when you lose the Mott insulator, you lose it completely. Yeah, but you see, the point is the RG. Yeah, no, but you see, the point, if I look at the RG will tell you that the two operator become relevant at the same time. But this is clearly an artifact of the weak coupling RG. And I don't know what will happen in the real flow, because I'm unable to determine the beta function exactly here. So in the weak coupling RG, no doubt that both operator becomes relevant at the same time. On the other hand, they correspond to operators coupling to dual phases. So if one is more relevant, it wants to kill the other. And whether there could be a phase, as I said, whether there could be a phase here, which is an intermediate phase, for example, where what you say happen, strictly speaking, I don't know the answer to this question. The only argument I can give against this is that for k equal 1/2 in mean field, we didn't see it. And this model is in the universality class of 4D XY model, for which people would say there is only one transition that can occur. But again, I don't have a microscopic calculation to guarantee you that this cannot happen. So this is, an interesting question. And as I said, there were a paper by Fertig who was saying that in some condition with this dual Sine-Gordon model, you could get intermediate phases. As I said, I think the condition he was mentioning in his papers were not fulfilled for this one because of the self-consistency equation. But you mean, as I said, for this, for all case, I would say no, there is no intermediate phase. But it's not something I can sign with my blood as if I had a microscopic calculation showing it. The only calculation I have is for k equal 1/2. So I cannot guarantee you that for k equal 1.2, for example, this will not occur. Yeah.
I think for this model, as you cross coarsen, you'll generate densely coupled.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
So then you could have a possibility of having, even a Mott insulator, you could have a possibility of having independent Mott insulators?
Sliding Luttinger liquids, sliding Luttinger liquids. So there are other equations, of course, in addition to this one that I wrote, which corresponds to the generated coupling. Again, it's very difficult because it's very difficult to control the flow there, but this coupling remains small by the time the others have reached coupling of other ones. So I think to give a complete answer to this question, one would need probably a numerical study of this model. Analytically, it's tough.
I'm just saying there might be something interesting in the
insulator. I agree with that. And we were playing a little bit with this coupling, but in at least reasonable cases, they were staying small. They were remaining small. But that's very good direction that one could explore.
Okay. Questions for lunch?
Lunch.
Thank you very much.